For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're working our way through 1 Timothy. We are in chapter 6 tonight, and we're going to look at verses 6 through 10, and then also verses 17 to 19, where Paul goes back to the same subject, which is namely the subject of wealth. So we're going to talk about money tonight. And religion and money is a weird mix. So we're going to try to unpack some of the thoughts about that. Let's take a look at what Paul has to say. He says to Timothy, godliness, this is a word that we've seen before. The Greek word is eusebia. It just means pleasing to God. That's probably a better synonym for it. When we live a life that's pleasing to God, he says, it is a means of great contentment. And he says, we brought nothing into the world, and so we can't take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering with that, we should be content. He goes on, he says, but those who want to get rich fall into temptation and snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. And here's the famous verse, correctly translated. It's not money is the root of all evil. It is, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a grief. He says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good and to be rich in good works and to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. And so here we have this awesome discussion here about gain and of contentment and of the whole relationship of the financial world to the spiritual world. And the context for this discussion actually is pretty important. It's established throughout the letter, but also, and very importantly, in the verse that precedes this paragraph, where Paul brings our attention to these people. He says, men of depraved minds and deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. And here he's talking about people who are looking to get wealthy from religion. It's not a new idea. It's been around a long time, the idea that you play to people's heartstrings, you say things that people really want to hear, and maybe if you're an especially flowery speaker or something like that, that people will send you money and they'll say, we want to hear more, and especially if you're promising them things in the name of God, they're definitely going to keep that flow going. And so religion has been good business and bad spirituality for a really, really long time. And so Paul is dealing with this phenomenon in the city of Ephesus, to which he has sent Timothy, and they are trying to address and just kind of smoke out these people, these kind of hucksters that are coming in and are ripping people off in the name of religion. So exploitation is a big part of the relationship of money and religion today, as it has been throughout history and across religious points of view as well. And so we're aware of that. We're also aware, however, on the other side, that there are imbalances in this area that also are important to understand and to be able to interact with in a productive way. That, yes, we're all very aware of the exploitative tendency among religious people. That's why, for instance, in this fellowship, we practice open accounting, that it is possible by just a simple request for anyone to get full financial disclosure where all of our money goes as a fellowship. You just need to call our controller and that material will be made available for you. But there's beyond that also, just I think maybe it's because of the way religion has been exploited over time and officially in the name of God for 1,000 or more years it was this way, that we have kind of retreated back, many of us in our thinking about money, to have adopted views that are really completely secular and have nothing to do with the Bible at all. And so some will teach, for instance, the health and wealth gospel that, you know, it's God's desire, God's will for you that you should be rich, and that if you're not, that it's really a consequence of your own lack of faith. And that idea is out there, and tragically is out there in some of the poorest places in the world, Latin America, Africa, places like that, setting up expectations for people's faith that have nothing to do with the Bible. We also have, and maybe more centrally to a culture like our own, really ideas about wealth that come to us not from the Bible, but from secular sources. The idea that every person has a divine or an inherent and inalienable right to wealth and to property, and that it is just, it's my stuff, it's my thing, I earned it, it's mine. And in some senses, of course, that is true. What we earn has been entrusted to us. But the reality from the Bible's point of view is that God is the sovereign and the owner of all creation, and that he puts us in where we are in space and time with the resources available to us to earn the things that we do so that we can be a steward of his resources for the purposes of what he is doing in us and through us to the world. It's a very different point of view than the basic idea that in Protestantism emerged really right during the earliest days of the Reformation, that the Reformation spread and Protestantism spread in Northern Europe especially, and in port cities in particular, where there was a huge amount of trade, a lot of wealth, an emerging mercantile and middle class that were really seizing hold of the idea of I can make money on my own. I don't need the king or empire or whatever. And so that whole philosophy of individualism and individual rights really emerges at the very same time as the true biblical Protestant teaching that every individual stands before God as well. And those two things often tragically have interlaced throughout Western history, really since the 16th century, leaving us with the strange ideas in many circles that wealth is a sign of God's blessing and that the lack of wealth is a sign of some moral defect, and that people who are poor are not just bad circumstanced, but there's something fundamentally wrong with their character as well. And we don't have time to unpack that whole thing, but it's an important discussion that how we think about wealth really is very significantly the product of the many things that influence us culturally and in our own backgrounds and from our own life situation. And so for these reasons, I think it's very important to walk through with Paul a frank, open discussion about this very, very important topic that affects all of us. Let's take a look at some of the language that he uses. I think it's important when we talk about money, no one's neutral about money. At least no one I've ever met. And it does, so the language that he uses here is, I think, really important. He talks about contentment, desire, love, longing, hope. All of these things are directly connected in some way with how we view wealth and how we view our own personal wealth. That's the context for each of those words right there. And these are words of passion. And the Christian faith, importantly, is not a stoic faith. It's not that we're to be unmoved and uninterested in the material world, because God created the material world. He placed us in the material world with a body. And so resources, things that wealth can produce and that we can acquire, relate in some ways to our spiritual lives as well. And the kind of contentment that Paul is calling on Timothy and the church that Timothy is working with to experience. He wants them to have desires that are satisfied in a godly way, that love that meets its appropriate end, longings that are fulfilled, a hope that is satisfied. All of these things, he's speaking to people in a material world, in a physical context, about the resources that are available to them to live life as an embodied soul in a good world that God created. And so we ought not to shrink back from this discussion of wealth and of money. because it is in an important way tied to these very things that every human being seeks. So this is a relevant discussion to all of us. Where we go with it, our ability to listen to Paul's teaching is going to tell us a lot about whether we'll experience the kind of contentment that we seek, to have the desires that we have fulfilled, and so forth. But let's dive into it here. When I talk about wealth, he says in verse 6, godliness, or a life pleasing to God, eusebia, is a means of great gain when it's accompanied with contentment. Now let's just unpack this just a little bit. There are four things that everyone agrees about with respect to wealth. And I mean everyone. Everyone who is a social scientist, who thinks about these things, who's looking to the scriptures and saying, what does it say about wealth and the acquisition of material things? And these four things are, first, that we seek more than we need. Animals seek what they need, right? They don't find animal banks, animal stores merchandising better nuts or whatever it is. Animals get what they need. Even when they're storing up for the winter, it's not because they just like to have nuts and various kinds of foods and stuff like that. It's just because that's the only way they'll survive for the winter. Human beings are fundamentally unique in that we seek more than we need. And some of that is pleasing and pleasurable and good, and some of that really is not, as we'll see. But the fact of the matter is, that's what we do. We seek more than what we need. The second is that wealth relates to our identity, our sense of who we are. And so we stratify our own society, every society, in terms of economic differences, the rich and the poor. We develop attitudes as poor people about what rich people are like, or as rich people, what poor people are like. And we have aspirations in the area of economic prosperity that we think are appropriate to such a person as myself. You see, and so it's impossible in the context that we live to think of ourselves independently of economic gains. Third, that where we stand and our attitudes about money, the practices that we are about as far as earning and spending money, reveal deeply our characters, and in the transaction with money shapes our character. Those are very important points, that the idea that finances and wealth is never value neutral. It is always in the realm of the moral, and that the way that we relate to finances, the way that we relate to wealth, actually has the effect of shaping our very character. We'll get into that also in just a bit here. Fourthly, very importantly, neither spirituality nor psychology is neutral with respect to money. Money, that is to say, is a spiritual issue and a psychological issue as well. And so there is, in fact, a whole kind of subset of sociology today called happiness study. And basically it is about the relationship of how people interact with the material at their disposal, their income and so forth, and the satisfaction of life that they experience. So where we're at psychologically, where we're at spiritually, in part has to do with our view and our practices as they relate to wealth. Now let's just develop this a little bit more fully here. I want to talk here about prosperity. And Paul says to Timothy, those who want to get rich have a problem. He's not saying, if you're rich, that's a sin. Okay? He's saying that those who want to get rich fall into a temptation. And that this desire can lead, and often does lead to ruin, he says, and destruction. What he's talking about here is essentially a value system. We call it material ism. It's an ism. Or in the parlance of contemporary social thinking, the word they use is affluenza, the disease of wanting more than you need to spend on yourself in an attempt to fulfill your deep needs and desires as a person. Affluenza has been used as a legal defense. There was a guy in Texas just a couple of years ago, a rich kid who went out and killed somebody out on the road and was taken to court, and his defense was affluenza. It was the idea that as a rich kid, I'm so far removed from the consequences of my behaviors that it never occurred to me that I should obey the laws of the state in terms of the traffic laws. Yeah, it's pretty funny. He is partially successful, actually, in his defense. The Bible calls it pleonexia. It sounds disease-like, too. I got a bad case of pleonexia. The translated word, a little more forceful, greed. That's what we're talking about here. Materialism essentially is greed. It is wanting something that you don't need and substituting something of real value to get it, okay? Pursuing something that you really don't need and compromising something of real value to get it. That's what greed is, and that's what affluenza is, and that's an epidemic in our society. We are a totally rich society, and we're a society that is being played. And I want to deliberate on this just a little bit. Nobody likes being lied to. Well, I don't like being lied to. I don't know about you. But we're being lied to big time. Our kids are being lied to daily, multiple times a day, dozens of times a day, scores of times potentially a day. We are being absolutely manipulated in a culture that are like ours that is a consumer economy. The vast majority of our economic life is rooted in the creating and the satisfying of unfulfilled desires. That's how our culture works. And media, advertising in particular, the social scientists of our day, the well-paid ones, are advertising people, understand human motivations and how to exploit human motivations toward material ends. And one of the central tenets of advertising and of a consumer economy, and it definitely plays into your thinking and mine, is the idea that you never have enough. What you have is not enough. It's not good enough. It's old, dated. It sucks. It's not like somebody else has. All of those things. And the whole world of commerce is rooted in the assumption that if we just help people feel discontent with what they have, then markets will go along swimmingly. Take a look at this little video piece that was forwarded to me by a friend. It's from an advertising convention just a couple of years ago. Check this out. This is pretty interesting.
Connecting with friends and family, enjoying nature, fulfilling our spirits. These are all activities that promote happiness, satisfaction, and a sense of well-being. But how might these activities affect our economy? The Global Alliance for Growth is devoted to that question. In partnership with industry leaders around the world, we have amassed the largest bank of big data ever. We're using advanced algorithms and one of the world's fastest supercomputers. We've developed something called the Consumer Mood Index, or CMI. And this tracks the overall life satisfaction of consumers in relation to their buying habits. We've discovered something incredible. There is a baseline level of life dissatisfaction that indicates optimal economic growth. You see, the ideal consumer is never truly satisfied, right? In fact, a general sense of boredom and dissatisfaction is key to engaging in consumer rituals. The Global Alliance for Growth is working hard to maintain an optimal CMI baseline through a technique known as targeted behavioral stimulation. We're using tools like neuromarketing, pharmaceutical instruments, and strategic neuromemes. And through these, we can create ideal psychological states or consumer rituals. And the neuromeme that I just mentioned, this is a powerful belief or attitude that we can strategically deliver through partnered broadcast media and internet channels. Directly target specific happiness factors like self-esteem, intellectual development, and personal safety. And we can also customize these messages to promote industry-specific consumer rituals that will benefit your enterprise while promoting global economic well-being. I see a couple of unhappy faces out there. Like, I understand, this is a controversial subject. How can we possibly prevent happiness? I have to ask you, how can we afford not to? Thank you.
Dude, that's some wild stuff. But it's basically saying what everyone is afraid to say, which is we need to be discontent. We need to not like what we have. We need to always feel like we must have more, newer, better. This? You laugh at my phone. I have this thing. You think it's ancient. You think it's silly. 10 years ago, I had no idea I even needed this thing, right? So it is with all of us. And so we have this system of values, this desire to manipulate desire for the sake of creating markets, of amassing more wealth for me. And that's the kind of milieu, that's the world that we live in, is just like that. You never had to have enough. You're never content. You've got to move up the corporate ladder. You got to buy more things. It's just this treadmill that knows no end. You're a junior partner working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week for that opportunity to become a senior partner when you can work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's crazy. We're told that we need to buy things that realize our ideal self. Who you are depends to a large measure on the things that you possess in this culture. And so, how are we pitched by way of advertising? Well, there's the appeal to vanity. You know, come to where the flavor is. Come to Marlboro country. So there's that association of this really cool guy riding horseback out in Wyoming or whatever, smoking his Marlboros for a while. Yeah, it came out a little more recently. You know what appeal to vanity is all about, right? You got this gorgeous babe saying, I like that smell. And you, as a salivating, testosterone-filled young man, like, okay. And you go out and you buy this thing, you know. You see the car attached to the cool guy, and you're like, I want to be like that. You know, and so you go out and buy this thing that you can't afford or whatever. Appeal to vanity. They know that your idealized self is up for grabs to shape and to be shaped and molded by the marketplace. Appeal to snobbery. Yeah, the ultimate driving machine. Why would I drive something not ultimate? You know, this is the ultimate driving machine, not my piece of crap that I've been driving around all these days. The bandwagon. McDonald's is master at it. They used to say over 100 million sold. I remember that as a kid. They'd have these signs up that say how many million hamburgers they sold. They gave up at a certain point. They were doing it into the billions. I think the last time I saw one, it said like 14 billion served. Now they just say billions and billions. Now, what does that mean exactly? It means that a lot of people eat these hamburgers. What is it not saying? These hamburgers are really bad for you. These hamburgers are sold in places where a lot of fairly marginally incomed people don't have access to grocery stores, and so they're left buying this kind of stuff to eat way too often to the detriment of their bodies. Billions and billions. I better dive in. I've got to be one of those billions. Appeal to elitism. Yeah, that's right. The few. The proud. The Marines. Well, there's pride in serving our country and defending it against its foes. But it's interesting that it would be sold in this kind of form of elitism. Or the Army put out a thing a few years back called the Army of One. Or be all you can be. And it's just this appeal to, you know, we're just a cut above the rest. And who doesn't want to be a cut above the rest? Who are you one who doesn't want to be a cut above? I want to be like Lake Wobegon, above average. We all want to be above average. I mean, if I'm average, what does that mean exactly? It means that at least half the people in the world are smarter, better looking, whatever, than I am. The Guardian is a British newspaper. They draw this conclusion about the appeal to fear, which you see in those home security things or in financial products that are sold and stuff like that. Advertising is about selling freedom from fear and targeting consumers' anxieties with that products that alleviate the worries. Whether it's fear of disease, attack of missing out, or whatever it is. Basically, it's the product, the ad is there to help you feel insecure where you never felt insecure before, and then to provide you the product that will alleviate that insecurity. I'm over 55. I get these magazines. I don't know, some of you get them. About, you know, if I don't inquire about taking this pill or that pill, my private parts will fall off. I'm going to stroke out and die. I'm going to exude odoriferous emanations that are offensive to people. I'm like, I don't know. I think I'm okay, but maybe not, you know? And so when just the fact that this is out there all the time then takes on a life of its own. And you begin to realize, I need it. I'm hearing I need it. Now I find out that this person's got it. And we are just being sucked right into a thing. You know, it's kind of funny, I think, to think about this. And in our reflective moments, we see right through it, don't we? Here's the problem. No reflective moments. We're not thinking. We're affected and we're reacting and we're doing, and it's too late. And the result of that is a very significant thing, especially in a world of easy credit. Well, it's a little bit harder now, but up to 2008, you know, things have changed. I was 30 years old. My wife and I bought our first house, $49,000 house. And when we were applying for a mortgage, we were asked to provide our debt history. And I'm like, well, it's like this. College in those days wasn't that expensive. I paid for it as I went. I don't have a credit card. Never had a credit card. All this kind of stuff. And here was the response. No credit is good credit. Not anymore. And now the idea is you've got to get yourself in debt just as soon as possible so that you can pay off this debt, so that your debt score is sufficiently high that you're paying less in interest for the loans that you must have to succeed in life. Treadmill, my friends. Treadmill. And just the level of consumer debt is unbelievable. And so this whole framework that our society has constructed around us facilitates, fosters risky, really addictive kinds of behavior. We've got some substance abuse experts in our fellowship and here tonight, in fact, who I think will readily show the connection between attitudes and behaviors about wealth and attitudes and behaviors about alcohol and other addictive substances. They're very similar. And how we approach these things affects our work life. What kind of a person is going to work 65, 70 hours a week for what is way beyond what they really need, unless they are addicted to the prestige symbols that this kind of work brings for them? What sane person puts themselves into tens of thousands of dollars of consumer debt on credit cards that charge interest rates of between 10 and 25%? That's not sane, normal activity, but it is this compulsion. I see it. It's on the internet. Therefore, it must be good. And click, you know, that's the thing. I just click. It's so easy. I'm insulated from the immediate effect. I just click. And it's so stimulating. What do I do? I'm going to click, 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 click. You know, I'm going to keep doing it. Addictive behavior. It affects our health. We're so invested in going out and making it big and succeeding that we're prepared to compromise our health, compromise the integrity of our families. I'm just too busy for you. And that is a very disease-like attitude. And this idea of affluenza is very pervasive. I've already talked about the impulse thing. We've got real problems in our society. Many of us here tonight have serious problems in the area of materialism. And it's just really got us by the scruff of the neck. And it's an issue in our lives. And I want us to think through this in a godly way, according to the framework of this passage. Materialism is at the core a spiritual problem. I want you to understand that. The problem with rampant indebtedness of a life that is all about the accumulation and spending of money to buy things that today seem so important that tomorrow we're like, why did I buy this thing? Is symptomatic of a deep spiritual blindness and deception, because there is an active personality behind our value system as a culture. The world system, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. And it is a spiritual battle that we're in this very important place in all of our value systems, what we do with money and its acquisition. To the Laodicean church, Jesus says in Revelation chapter 3, verse 17, he says, "You say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have no need." He says, "You do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." And we live in a culture that is so profoundly lacking in contentment. It is an amazingly affluent culture. We here, every one of us here tonight, are living like kings compared to 95% of the world. You have to understand that. You have to know that. You say, "I feel poor." No. You may be broke, but you're not poor. And the resources available to you and so forth are just out there. We're not poor in that sense. And it is to the rich that Jesus says, "You say we've become wealthy, we have no need. We've got life on our terms, we're living large, it's all great." And he says, "But you know what? There's inwardly something that you can't buy. That you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." And so many of us who are from affluence and who are affluent, we play this game that everything's great and everything's all right. And you know what? It just isn't all right. You ask your kids, where are kids having difficulty with drug addiction and with suicides and things like that. It's in the affluent communities. It's in Worthington. It's in Dublin. It's in Westerville. It's in your communities as well, because these kids can't live with the value system that we either inadvertently or in a very deliberate way have cultivated around them. It's too much. Jesus says in Luke 15, 12, verse 15, he says, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of pleonexia. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." You can't buy your way to happiness. You can't buy your way to love. You can't buy your way to fulfillment. It can't be done, because why? Not even when you have an abundance does your life consist of those things. You own them, but they don't meet those deep, real inner needs that we all have. And so these are spiritual issues that we are wrestling with as a society. Let's talk then about what's good news here. The contentment that twice Paul refers to in this passage, in verse 6 and in verse 7. What is this contentment that he refers to? It's three things. First, he ties it to godliness, Eusebia. God, a life pleasing to God is a life that is full of contentment, a God-centered basis for life, so that we're not trying to extract our reason for being, our value as a person, our identity, the satisfaction of our deep desires on stuff, on things that can never satisfy deeply who we are as human beings, because the reality is we are more than consuming machines. And consumption will never lead to satisfaction. What will lead to true contentment is a God-centered basis for life. Paul says, fix your hope not on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. And so it's like when our focus becomes God, and we are moving His way, and we are learning, what does it mean, Lord, for me to be pleasing to You? And having that, taking that pressure off the need to consume and to buy, what we find instead is a deep sense of contentment. I was blown away. Most poignant example of contentment I've ever had came about 2.5 years ago now in a tent city in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. It was the poorest place on the earth. Over 1 million people living as internal refugees after the earthquake that went down in 2010. Tens of thousands of people in each of these little communities, their tents tied wall to wall for a sea of filth for as long as you could see. No running water, no electricity. The crime was unbelievable. And going back in there, and there were tent churches that had been formed. And people were there with warmth, with delight, with an other-centered desire to say to me as a North American that make in a month more than everyone in that community does cumulatively. How are you? How can I pray for you? God is good. We're getting by. Our needs are met. And I'm like, oh. You know, I got up this morning grumbling that my tube of toothpaste might not last me for the next couple days or whatever. And these people who haven't seen a tube of toothpaste in a couple of years are like, we're doing okay. God is good. When we draw our life from the living God who created us for that purpose. It doesn't justify poverty or the indifference to poverty, but what it says is that at the core of who we are, that if we are vitally connected to Him who is the source of life, that we will be able to experience life in a way that's not materially dependent in that way. And so for those of us who are rich, but not really rich, but who are poor and naked and miserable, Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock, and if anyone hears my voice, I will come in." Here's the thing, and the offer to you here tonight. Maybe you've been trying to cram experiences that you are able to buy, things that you're able to buy, living this incredible life of going out and earning and spending and trying to make it work and living the American dream, and you just are empty inside. Maybe that's you. My friends, it is your neighbor. And the offer that God has before you is this. He is standing on the threshold of your life, and He's knocking on your door, and He's saying, what you're trying to fill your home with will never satisfy. Open the door of your heart to me. Let me come in. Let me enter your life. Let me forgive you of your guilt and the shame that you feel. Wash that away on the basis and the authority of the cross of Christ that once and for one time paid for the guilt of all of humanity. Let me enter into your life and give you that forgiveness. Let me fill you with my Spirit and give you that living, real contact with the one true God who created you in His image and for the purpose of a relationship with you. Just open the door of your heart. Don't burn your credit cards. Don't swear a vow about how much you're going to work, whatever it is. Right now, who you are, where you are, just open the door of your heart and say, I want to be forgiven and I want to be reconciled, and I understand that offer is being presented to me freely through Jesus Christ, and I want to receive that. That's all that is at stake. That's the whole shooting match right there. And what will happen is we'll have a growing sense of peace and of contentment in our life. And the pull of these things that we've been describing here tonight have less and less of a claim on our life. And there's freedom that comes for that. And God wants to call you to freedom in this area. Second, He says, instead of amassing wealth that is going to rust and be passed on to somebody else or whatever it is and will not satisfy, He says, store up instead treasure of a good foundation for the future. And so that you can take hold, He says, of that which is real life. Life indeed. What is He talking about here? He's saying essentially what the rest of the scriptures teach, that you are shaped by what you invest in. Jesus put it this way. He says, where your treasure is, there will your heart lie also. What has your affections has this power to begin to shape you and mold you so that you become increasingly a reflection of the object of your desires. When we pursue things that are not God's purpose for us, we are misshaped and we are broken in that way. And the converse is also true, that when we pursue God and the things of God, this also has the ability to transform our affections, to transform our inner life, to give us an experience of what God intends for us to have, real peace, real wealth. That's God's intent. Only purposeful love relationships ultimately satisfy. First with God, but then again, outwardly to others, as we talked about last week. Do you believe that? Need to think about that. Do you believe that? Because there are huge implications to this. All right? Here's the proposition on the table. Only purposeful love relationships really satisfy deep down in those desires that drive us, that need for love, for connection, for belonging, for significance. Only love relationships make those things possible. Do you believe that? Because this is going to then define the trajectory of your life. It brings us to our last point, the habit of generosity. Here he says, instruct them, that is those who are rich in this world, to do good and to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. A habit of generosity, that's what we're talking about here. And what does that mean exactly? Four things I want to leave us with here. What does it mean to seize hold of that which is life indeed? To say, I do believe that the only thing that will provide for me what I deeply seek in my life is love relationships and reflecting the love of God to other people. If I believe that that's true, that is going to impact how I steward the resources that God has given to me. And I'm asking myself this question. Am I as intentional about growing in Christian service as I am growing in my career? A lot of us are on the front end of our career life here tonight. Now is the time to ask this question before the golden handcuffs come on the wrist. And you're paying for a mortgage that requires this income and all of the stuff that goes with it, and you are stuck with something that isn't going to satisfy, whereas God is putting on the table for you something that really will. Am I as intentional about growing in my expertise in Christian service as I am attentive to my career objectives? That's the first question. That would be a great conversation for any of us, just to be able to sit down with a trusted friend and say, what do you think about that, as far as I'm concerned? Are you concerned? What do you think? Second, do I have wise, godly counsel in the area of finances in my life? Wow, we're not supposed to talk about the money we make or how we spend it in our culture. That's your sacred stuff. Well, okay, fine. You live that way if that's what you want to do. But if you want to have freedom in the financial area, freedom from the clutches of materialism as it is just utterly surrounding all of us, it is important for us to have sanity about our financial life and to have knowledgeable, godly counsel about our wealth and how to steward that. Do we have people in our lives, in our home churches, that know what we make, for instance? Or what our financial priorities are? And that's pretty countercultural stuff, isn't it? You know, it's none of your business. Well, okay, fine. But it's your business, and if you want to be smart about it, you ought to be talking about it, too. Do I give sacrificially? Here's a question. Do I give to the things that God is doing as an afterthought or as a very intended part of my financial life, as a central priority of why I've been given by God the economic opportunities that I have? We have been blessed for the purpose of being a blessing. We talked about that last week. Do you give sacrificially? That means, is there something, a consistent pattern where I'm giving to the things that God is doing at the expense of things that I would really like to have for myself? That would be a sacrifice. We can be generous and give significant amounts of money. But the question is, does it have any bearing whatsoever on our life? Is it sacrificial in that sense? And that's what the scriptures call us to, is the widow's mite. She gave a little bit of money, but in terms of what it meant to her, it was more than what everyone else gave. Do we give sacrificially in this way? And lastly, this kind of brings it all back around. The whole thing here that we've been talking about is the lie of the world system that keeps us lacking in contentment, always wanting more, always thinking what we have is not good enough, always looking to other people's stuff, always competing for better, for more, all of this stuff. Here's what breaks that cycle. Are you grateful for what you have? Just what you have. Is that okay? Are you grateful for that? Thank you, Lord, that you've provided for me this house, this car, these clothes, this stuff that I have. Because when we're in that place, what happens is we just don't feel like we really need much. That desire begins to dissipate, and the pleasure of a desire that's satisfied by involving ourselves sacrificially in meeting the needs of others takes on a delight that just makes the pull of that other stuff begin to fade into the background. And that's God's intent for us. This is spiritual survival in a materialistic society. That's what we're talking about here. Gratitude. Well, just thanks for this awesome fellowship that you've given to us, Lord, and that we can share in tonight over dinner. Just pray that we'd be able to keep in mind some of the important parts of this conversation we've had tonight so that we would be able to leverage those friendships into a deeper discussion of these things, more accountability, more freedom that you want us to all have. So thanks for these things in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.